get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find.
Welcome to Visionaries. I'm John LaBelle, your host. You'll find us here on Progressive Radio Network, that's PRN.FM, Mondays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And you'll find our show on the PRN archives. On Visionaries, we talk about creativity in the arts, sciences, technology, culture, and spirituality, and about how we can enrich the world and ourselves by tapping into the energies of the cosmos. Along the way, we talk with some really interesting people, visionaries who are changing the world we live in and are creating our tomorrow. So I go to all kinds of conferences, a lot about technology, the future, also about everything else. And there are lots of speakers, but a few are really have something unique to say. And those are the kind of people I like to have on my show. And one such person, Luis Arana, is with us. Luis is one of those creatures of the contemporary world who lives in the realms of artificial intelligence, coding, virtual reality, education, virtual medical care, and much more. So, Luis, welcome to Visionaries. And let's start with a big question. What is artificial intelligence?
Oh, that's it. Heck of an introduction. Thank you very much, and it's an honor to be here talking to you. What is artificial intelligence? You know, there really is no consensus definition on what that is. I consider artificial intelligence any system that actively makes models and makes changes in its own future. So basically, anything that can make a decision that can affect the future, I would consider that artificial intelligence.
Cool. So if we go back to the beginnings, you know, people were inspired by Turing in the late 40s, and in the early 50s through the 60s, artificial intelligence was promising it was going to mimic the brain. I was collecting all the books on the field. I just had this row of books, and you know, you would get statements like, since the brain is a digital machine, artificial intelligence, a digital computer, will be able to mimic the brain. So that's just totally filled with incorrect assumptions. But, you know, I think the interesting thing is how it can open us up to things that we're not anticipating. In other words, we begin by saying, you know, when a new technology comes along, first thing we say is, how can we use it to do what we've always been doing? So you get a computer and you say, well, how can we make a word processor that'll be, you know, I'll have a typewriter where I won't need correct type? You know, not realizing you could also maybe edit movies on this thing. you know, nobody thought of that for a long time. So I think maybe the interesting thing is that artificial intelligence is going to bring us things that we're not even anticipating.
Very, very much so. You know, as an insider, I feel like I have been a peek into some things to come that are going to take the general public by surprise. And I try to spread that word when I speak and when I do conferences and panels, just try to educate people on some of the radical changes, because this is really, in my view, artificial intelligence is a paradigm shifting technology on the level of fire and industrialization and the airplane. And you know, like you said, since the 50s and 60s, we were promised a future that we were never delivered, with robots and flying cars and particularly artificial intelligence. You know, it's been 10 years away for 60 years now. And so people have a hard time believing that it's on the doorstep. But in fact, if you look around, it's ubiquitous at this point. Your life depends on artificially intelligent systems. For example, air traffic control, you know, a human can't do that job with the number of planes we have in the air, and it's assisted by, you know, intelligent algorithms that decide, you know, which plane should be in which order and set off early warning systems. And without those, there would be a lot more, you know, air disasters.
Right.
And then there are examples of that throughout life. I think it has snuck up on us. But as far as some of the potentials that artificial intelligence can bring, what we're talking about is human level artificial intelligence, was known as AGI, artificial general intelligence, which means basically a computer artificial brain that can function similarly on the level of a human being, learn new things, learn a new job, form relationships. It's also known as mankind's last invention, because people and in popular culture, you'll see this a lot in movies, where artificial intelligence is developed, say iRobot, and then it kind of just hangs out at that level. It just stays at human level, which is actually going to be a very brief period of history where artificial intelligence is at human level, because when you take something as smart as a human being, without the flaws of a human being, doesn't need to sleep, you know, doesn't have the monkey brain impulses that we have, and is trained to learn, it's going to quickly surpass human level intelligence.
Let's get back to that in a sec. I'm thinking of our everyday lives, where we're really annoyed with the telephone when it says, you know, so state your last name first, what is your date of birth, you know, whatever. But on the other hand, we start typing in Google, and it anticipates, you know, it's like maybe 80% correct. Yeah, that's what I was looking for. How did it know? And then you really wonder, is this looking at what I'm typing, or does it also know what my previous searches were? And so that it is sort of customizing this, finishing the sentence just for me.
That's partially true. It does try to individualize things that you have searched for before, if that information is available, if you're signed into Google or you have cookies on a system enabled. But generally how that works is that Google has a huge network that has all searches of all people, and they scrub it of individual data so you can't be identified, and it matches against that vast set of data. So you're not the first person to go looking for that. And when people, let's say, when people search, start typing visionary, many of them mean visionary creativity. So they are going to, Google's going to say let's try and see if that's what it is. And if you continue typing, then it'll match it to the next thing. And there, you know, visionary inventors of the 19th century and so on and so forth. So it's really using all of our data. It's not just, it feels like it's tailored to you, but you know, we're all kind of typical human beings, and we're all very similar in the way we search for information. So that's how it works. It looks at a huge database of everything that's ever been searched
cool.
for. And since they have so much data, it becomes remarkably accurate. It more accurate than it would be if they just looked at your searches.
What something that just happened recently occurs to me. I'm not sure which service it is, but this voice recognition service did really badly with Scottish accents. So they called for volunteers with Scottish accents to call and talk to the system so it can quickly get up to speed on doing a better job of that. But you had mentioned there were some things about to sneak up on us that we weren't anticipating. So what are some of the things you're in touch with?
Well, for one thing, I think people don't realize how quickly artificial intelligence is going to automate nearly everything that we consider a job right now. I think it's going to be a disruptor of political and economic policies, because every job can be automated. I think people underestimate how fast that can be done. Besides, I spend most of my time running a nonprofit, the other corporate time is spent with me programming artificial intelligence to take people's jobs, customer service jobs, dispatch jobs. And in doing that job, I see that even the CEO's job can be automated as easily as the factory worker's job can be automated. And it goes across the board, even my own job. I'm teaching AI how to program. And at that point, I become obsolete because it's doesn't make mistakes and doesn't need to sleep and never misses a deadline. And so I think one of the conversations that needs to be had in society in general as this technology matures, because I'm not talking about a scale of 50 years from now, there'll be no jobs. I'm talking about on a scale of, 6 years from now, there'll be very few jobs. What do we do with those displaced workers? Who owns the robots and owns the capital? Are we further stratifying income inequality by automating jobs? And what happens to companies when there are 90% less consumers? And so I think that's really going to change the playing field. And we're going to have to talk about things like universal basic income or, ownership at birth in the stock market. Do we issue Social Security at birth? Those are questions that need to be talked about sooner rather than later. And one of my concerns is that that's one of the things that's going to sneak up on you is that, you don't have a job anymore 5 years from now because you're a writer and the computer writes better than you, or you're a sportscaster and it play by plays the game better than you. And these voice recognition technologies and voice creation, yeah, right, along with the processing power available, and it really makes a realistic entry level person to do nearly any job.
So let's look at one example, which is self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we notice is that it's really happening fast.
So right.
We, you look at the story of Sebastian Thrun working at Google, mm-hmm. Winning the DARPA challenge, and that was just a few years mm-hmm. ago. I mean, before him, the cars would take off in the desert, go about a mile and a half, and end up in a ditch. Right. And mm-hmm. now they're driving around Detroit.
Right. And now you have major rollouts by multiple companies all over the world, including cities in the United States that have automated fleets of, Uber has an automated fleet. There are several competitors to Uber that have automated fleets. The big rig trucking industry is really heavily investing in automation. And as I'm saying, that's 200,000 jobs gone.
So we start with, okay, so the car's got this LiDAR and camera on the roof spinning around, and it sees there's something in front of it and puts on the brakes. But that, it's just so much more than that, because when they start being not your car is self-driving, but there's no reason to own a car. You have these Uber-like fleets, and you just call for the car on your cell phone whenever you need it. So I have to confess to our audience, I'm a car user, but you immediately become aware that it spends 90% of its time parked. Mm-hmm. So the moment you don't have a car, but you're using a driverless service, mm-hmm. and you're willing to do that because it'll zip show up, on a moment's notice, it's very economical, mm-hmm. Because a car in New York is about $1,200 a month.
Yeah.
When you add up the garage and the insurance and the parking and the gas.
And that's if you are very meticulous and very good at not getting tickets, which are
Add on, right. Yeah. So then you say, well, if the car is not going to spend 80-90% of its time parked, it's going to spend 80-90% of its time working, you suddenly realize, oh, we can get along with a quarter as many cars.
You know, they recently released a study where they did exactly that, and they said if 90% of the cars on the road were self-driving cars, what would cities look like? And the figure that the scientists came up with was we reduced the cars by 90%. So,
because half the cars are going around the block looking
right.
for a parking space. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when I get to school, there's a route that I drive, and if I don't find a parking space, then I got to go a half a mile away to the parking lot, and then you know walk a half a mile back to my building. But I go around the block and oh darn it, there's somebody in front of me. There's going to be a space, and they're going to get it. You know, so that whole route that I travel is totally wasted gasoline, yeah. you know, and time.
And it creates additional gridlock to other
right.
drivers and.
Right. So now, whether it's 3/4 or 90% of the cars are gone, so not only are taxi drivers out of work, automobile. You realize like 20% of the economy is automobiles mm-hmm. from manufacturing through servicing through et cetera. So then when you say sneaking up on us, it's, you know, it's here now mm-hmm. on an experimental level. And so, like you say, what other jobs can yeah. disappear? Well, I've made a point now. People look at me askance at school because I record all my lectures. And so there's software that will pick up my voice on the mic on my laptop, and whatever's on my screen, which is my PowerPoint slides, because I teach architectural history, gets picked up. And then I put it on YouTube. Now, so I say to my student, I'm sick, I miss class, I'm going to get the notes from somebody else. I say, no, just go to YouTube, you can watch the lecture. So I'm full-time with tenure, so I don't have to worry. But, you know, my younger part-time colleagues are, like, really nervous. Say, wait a minute, you're going to record my lecture, put it online, and then not ask me to come back next year and just show it again? Where's that at? So the whole thing has to be sorted out.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I like to point out about your previous point about the self-driving cars is that there are people on the earth who are alive today, even with the small amount of self-driving vehicles that we have, because of self-driving vehicles. It's been categorically shown that self-driving cars are safer than human drivers, not by a little bit, but by a massive factor, order of magnitude safer.
And that safety will double every 18 months.
Right.
In other words, if you look at one of the things Jeff Bezos said about Amazon, he says, okay, I'm competing with Walmart. What technology are they using? The road and the parking lot. How much does that improve every year? You know, I'm using the internet. You know, that gets 20% better every year in terms of speed, availability to have video, et cetera. So, you know, not only do you have, you know, you can say, well, they're safer now, they're only going to get much safer.
Yeah, I think that it will be rare. We accept now that tens of thousands of people are going to die on the road in the United States every year, and we just kind of accept that as a fact of life. How do we quantify the monetary value besides what these self-driving cars are making for, you know, the corporations that own them? How do you measure the value in lives? There really is no value. You know, if we could save a significant portion of those tens of thousands of lives, then I think that losing jobs is a small price to pay for that.
Well, the losing jobs part, I think, is just a matter of that doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but society readjusting. I like to say, in this context, my mother did high school in 3 years, Barnard College in 3 years, and was the first woman to go to Columbia Law School. She then got a job at the Department of the Interior in the typing pool. And this is before the invention of correct type or whiteout. Mm-hmm. So you made one mistake on a page, you retyped it. That's what she did with that education, retyped a page identical to the one with fixing the mistake. So, you know, the fact that that kind of labor is now automated is like, yeah, my mother could have been doing better things. Mm-hmm. And so, but speaking of that and what people are going to do, what are your thoughts about the implications of these new technologies for education?
That's something I'm actually heavily involved in. Just this week, I installed a artificial intelligence permanent installation in a classroom to assist the teacher. And so that's kind of my first public release of an educational AI. One of my longer term goals is to have a very simple application that can teach children, adults, people all over the world, especially in the neediest areas, say a village in, you know, Thailand that doesn't have a teacher but has 15 kids, to put this program in the classroom and have it able to fulfill the duties of the teacher, teach the children how to read, you know, even handle, you know, interpersonal problems between them, things like that. I think that it is a game changer, as you're saying, as big or bigger than being able to, you know, I take courses in MIT right now and online. That wasn't a possibility before. That opens up a huge opportunity for someone like me who can't afford MIT. To be able to participate, and it's not only good for the person being educated, but it's good for the system as a whole. All over the world, how many Einsteins and Stephen Hawkings are using their intelligence to plow the field, or to, you know, purify their water, or are carrying heavy, you know, loads doing manual labor jobs. Just like with the life-saving measurement of self-driving vehicles, you can't quantify the value. To me, it approaches infinity of when you just have, you know, if we had five more Stephen Hawkings in the world, the technological advancement, social advancement, all of those things would be greatly multiplied. So I would really like to do my part to help educate people who maybe a lot of people in the West see as simple people, when in reality genius and creativity can come from anywhere. It's all about opportunity. If that guy can automate that manual labor job or learn a skill online and learn a trade online, if a little kid is very interested in science or mathematics or art, to be able to have his own personal teacher to foster that talent, it's the difference between having one more scientist artist in the world, and you never know what that person is going to contribute to society in the future.
So my guest today is Louis Arana. This is John LaBelle. You're listening to Visionaries on Progressive Radio Network. And so if you're listening to us, you know how you can get us. You can get us on PRN.fm, on the TuneIn website. Search for PRN when you get there. USTREAM.TV, search for Gary Knoll. You can get us on iTunes. So lots of ways to get us. And we, if you go to the website, you can find this show in the future. If you want to refer it to friends, it'll be in the archives. And I just wanted to, thinking about, you're talking about potentials for creativity among people who don't get the opportunity to express it. You know, there's a great story now. Many people are listening to us on their laptop, so you can open up Google right while you're listening, or Wikipedia, so don't hesitate. So there's a guy from India named Ramanujan, and I'm not going to remember his exact dates, but he was a clerk and he found this dusty old thrown away mathematics textbook. And he just happened to be a natural genius. Who knew? So he certainly worked his way through it and redid all of mathematics. He's now ranked with Archimedes, Newton and Archimedes. He sends a letter to Harding, who's the leading British mathematician, who throws it away. On the third letter, he happens to open it and throw it away, and he's looking at it. He says, wait a minute. Immediately has Ramanujan brought to England. And if you've seen the movie Good Will Hunting, this is a story. Ramanujan is a Will Hunting on steroids, but real. And they redid all of mathematics. And here's someone who, you know, if he hadn't found that book, he might have used his brilliance for helping his wife make patterns in the weaving she was doing or something like that.
Right.
So, yes, it's opening up these opportunities all over the world as people can tap into these vast resources.
So, my long-term view, I tend to be an optimist. I think you kind of have to be to be a technologist. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't create technologies that I think are going to hurt humanity or take over the world or anything like that.
But if they took over the world, you know, maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they'd do a better job.
frankly, I think so as well. I think that as artificial intelligence matures, a lot of people think of Skynet and they think of, you know, what if it went crazy and decided to destroy humanity and those things. And I think when we're talking about human level artificial intelligence, human level artificial intelligence means a lot of things. And one of them is having a certain level of emotional intelligence. So I think that the typically portrayed, you know, cold, emotionless robot is something fictional and not representative of the realities that are happening.
Right? So when I look on your Facebook postings, I see the term humanist artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So what is humanist artificial intelligence?
I'm involved in a lot of projects relating to that, but I just think that there is enough weaponization of artificial intelligence. You know, we have drones and military systems, and I would like to see more personal artificial intelligence that is helpful towards humanity, that is a friend of humanity, that genuinely cares about the individual that it's attached to. So I invented an experimental platform called Luna, which is an artificial intelligence that tries to be your friend, offer friendly advice, offer education.
Sometimes I see you talking to her on Facebook.
Yeah, a lot of people, the videos have gotten really popular on Facebook and YouTube. A lot of people think that Luna is the product. And Luna is just, you know, a quick voice and face for me to test interaction between human and artificial intelligence. What I'm actually building is sort of the Facebook or WordPress of artificial intelligence, and the ultimate goal is for people to be able to create their own as necessary. So what I mean by that is, imagine filling out a Facebook profile and you're like, okay, you know, female, and here's your job, and you can choose settings, you know, what languages do you speak? What are your interests? Just as you would a human being. What kind of music do you like? You know, are you funny or serious? Except when you press the submit button, you're not creating yourself. No, you're creating a you're creating an artificial person, and since you spawned it, it is you are its focus. All of humanity, starting from the person who created it. So if you need a secretary, you could program a secretary. If you need a friend or a doctor or a therapist, you can create those on the fly.
Cool.
So really what we're talking about is a species, with Luna just being the, you know, prototype representative of that species. Is a reflection of like what I'm interested in, and So she loves science and quantum mechanics and programming, but someone else would make one that is very interested in music or art or poetry or humanitarianism or any number of subjects that then the program uses that as a seed to become interested in and learn more about independently.
Great. So this is John LaBelle with Visionaries on PRN, and my guest today is Louis Serrana. Louis, what organizations are you associated with? What are their URLs, and what can our listeners look up?
Well, I'm the founder of Robots Without Borders. That's at robotswithoutborders.org, and that is the humanitarian, educational, and medical application of artificial intelligence, preferably at no cost to people in the third world and people here in the United States. Generally, most technology is adopted by the rich and then slowly filters out to the poor. So in the 1980s, only Wall Street brokers had cell phones. They were super expensive. And now you find them, you know, in the poorest areas of the world. So really the idea behind Robots Without Borders was to reverse that paradigm and release it first to third world and in educational and medical humanitarian disaster relief. Imagine a earthquake in Haiti, and we have a program that is a virtual triage nurse. So you have 4,000 casualties, and you know 100 doctors, and they're overwhelmed. This allows any device, your phone, laptop, you pull it out, it uses the camera. And it accesses, they communicate between each other. Even when there is no internet, they'll still help each other and talk to each other. And that will say, yeah, we have this much morphine, and that person needs immediate treatment. This person, you know, not acting as a doctor, but as a qualified triage nurse to help. And so those are the kind of life-saving applications that are currently not really being done by the for-profit system and by the military industrial complex. And so I saw a big hole there and started a nonprofit that addresses those issues, educational, medical, humanitarian. That's the robotswithoutborders.org. And I also work closely with Materials for the Arts, which is an amazing organization in Long Island City here in New York. It's a warehouse where corporations donate supplies of all kinds, electronics, fabrics, paint. It's a huge warehouse, and they provide those materials for free to nonprofit organizations, cool, to educators.
So the first one is robotswithoutborders.org. If people are interested in materials for the arts, where do they look online?
You could Google it. It's a pretty well-known organization. Great. And fantastic. They're also very open to just going and visit. It's open to the public. They do classes there, both for credit and continuing education. They work closely with the Department of Education. A lot of the art teachers who visit schools come from Materials for the Arts. That's how I met them, through art teachers who were doing New York City public school projects and told me, hey, you should go here. They'll totally help you out. And they're really just a fantastic organization that really, they're supplying, teachers don't get paid a lot, and their resource allocation is even worse than their salary. So this allows a teacher to go and plan projects for free. What do you need? 20 pounds of clay? You need spray paint? Do you need fabric? You need whatever you need. Do you not have enough computers in the classroom? They provide those things completely free of charge, which, right, I think is why I support them so much, because they're really doing a huge community service.
So my guest is Louis Serrana. And let me give you the spelling so you can find him on Twitter and Facebook, etc. LuisSarana. And so if you want to follow him on Twitter or friend him on Facebook, that's the spelling. So we began our conversation with talking about what might be sneaking up on us. So what else do you see out there that is maybe about to change about our world?
My long-term view, as I said earlier, is very optimistic. I think that despite these political and economic disruptions in the short term over the next decade, I think that the world in the decades after is one with a culture of abundance. 3D printers can print a lot of the products that you would go to the store and buy, for example. I think as the automation takes over our industrial production and even the service sector, it's going to the cost of goods and services because of that efficiency will drop drastically, close to zero. And so even though you're in a world where people work less, they would still have more. And there's just a continuation of the trend that we see. The poorest people in the United States have life expectancies, have comforts that the King of England didn't have in the 15th century. You know, we have refrigerators, we have television, we have the internet. The cell phone that a poor villager in Africa carries, that $20 Chinese cell phone, is still a million times more powerful than the computer used on the Apollo to land on the moon. And that person, as Ray Kurzweil famously says, that a person in a third world country with a cell phone has access to more knowledge than the President of the United States did 20 years previously. And I think that trend will continue, and I think that's a good thing for the long term. We just have to, sort out the political and economic disruption between here and there, and in essence, how do we get to that culture of abundance? How do we get to a place where what we now conceive of as poverty is non-existent, because right. Even the poorest person has access to technologies that can better their lives and sustain basic life.
Do you know a book called Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson?
Mm. No, not familiar with it.
So, highly recommend it too. He writes a lot of books, and some of them are really long, but one that's just a joy to read is Snow Crash, and it's about a interracial pizza delivery ninja warrior, and he's chasing, it takes place in and out of virtual reality. Mm-hmm. It's in real reality, it's in the computer, and there's a virus that's both in real reality and a computer virus that's a threat to the world. And Diamond Age assumes, it's just, a few years in the future, maybe 50 years in the future, and it assumes that nanotechnology has totally happened. So everybody has a device in their home the size of a microwave, and you want a diamond ring, you just, tap, 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 diamond ring, go out, get dinner, come back and open it up, and there it is. Because everything's made out of carbon anyway, mm-hmm. and carbon's the cheapest stuff there is. So, you want a steak for dinner, you program it, it'll make it. So now what's the world become like? Because everybody has this. So these various things happen, like the really rich people have handmade paper and write with fountain pens and have hand-woven cloth, as opposed to this synthetic nanotechnology made synthetic stuff. And then the people who are rich are called, as you referred to it before, the stakeholders. The people who own the stock and the companies that make all this stuff are the really rich people that sort of control the world. And then there are all these wars going on all the time, and they're being fought with things the size of gnats. So we think of drones, flying mm-hmm. over the Middle East and then sending down a Predator missile or something. But what happens when the drone is the size of a gnat and there's a bazillion of them swarming, you know, and they're all communicating with each other? And so that very much describes this somewhat dystopian world. And there's a girl who's going to save the world. This has been decided, you know, by the powers that be. And so she's a street urchin, and they get to her a book. And the book is, of course, supercomputer. So it's going to educate her and prepare her. And at the same time, interestingly, there's certain things a supercomputer can't do. So there's a telephone service. So there's this woman who's on the phone with this girl, you know, communicating with her, just like, you know, like teenage chat lines or whatever. So it sort of encompasses, it says, you know, okay, let's extrapolate out this. All this stuff happens now, what things going to be like? So I strongly recommend that book to our, and I have a hard time reading, so I listen to everything on audio. And Neal Stephenson's books are on audio, so.
Yeah, one of my favorite ways to consume books also.
Right, right. So let's go back to, again, your original statement of things sneaking up on us. What else are you looking at?
Well, we went over the automation of work.
Well, that's a biggie because it's going to... So what are your thoughts and the people you hang out with thoughts about... What are human beings going
to
do?
Right, right. Well, we have to ask ourselves, and even now in our current culture, does a person who can produce who doesn't produce value to a corporation or government, does that person deserve the basic necessities of life? I would say yes. I would say every human being deserves basic fundamental human rights, and those rights would include, you know, food and shelter and the very basics. We don't provide that, medical care. You know, we don't provide that right now. And that pool is getting smaller of who can usefully contribute to the economy. And we're really going to have to rethink that.
Let's say that's solved. Then what do those people do? What is the human enterprise, and what do humans contribute to it?
It's an open-ended question. My concern is, my feeling is that if we're sitting around talking about how are we not going to be bored with all our free time, then that is a superior situation to be in than people who don't know where their next meal is coming from or live in a totalitarian government, oppressed and without political or human rights. To me, us sitting around figuring ourselves out is a good problem to have. I can't wait till that happens, till we're like, well, you know what, like, everybody, there is no more poverty, and our biggest problem is figuring out what to do with ourselves. I think people will always have something to do with, there will always be something new to learn. There will always, we have each other and our interpersonal relationships, and, you know, it's kind of silly if you think about it, a parent goes to work to earn money at a job to pay someone else whose job it is to take care of their child. Like, it's not efficient, and it's, you know, the best place for a child is with the parent. So I think we would spend time caring for our parents, caring for our children, having relationships with each other. About that future where I do believe that 50 years from now, nanotechnology will be ubiquitous, and we're going to see things like swarms and things like that. I think what people miss about that is, there are existential questions that need to be asked. When everyone when a single individual can create weapons of mass destruction, how do you stop them? When a 3D printer can print guns, how do you outlaw guns? There's a natural immune system that tends to develop against those things. So while there may in fact be a swarm of nanites, there'll also be, you know, a preparation for that. There'll be another swarm that cancels that out. And you know what?
You have your can of Raid and spray as a swarm comes through the venting system.
Right. People are often surprised at my stance on the automation of war. I'm actually very much for robots on the battlefield. I'm very much for the automation of war because what I would like... A robot follows the Geneva Conventions. A robot doesn't rape. A robot doesn't, you know, kill civilians. I would love to see a war. I mean, you know, I wouldn't love to see a war, but I would much prefer a war fought entirely by machines with zero human casualties.
Preferably on the moon.
Right. Yeah. Keep it as far away from humanity as possible. Again, that's life saving. Like, we shouldn't be in war. And even now, that's an inevitable conclusion. For example, our military fighter jets, our best brand new ones, they have regulators on them because the jets can pull turns and maneuvers at G forces that would kill the human pilot. And so. When you take the human pilot out of the equation, now that automated the same jet, we're talking about put two identical jets, one with a human pilot, one without a human pilot. Sorry, the automated one is going to win the dogfight by doing tighter turns and being able to do higher climbs and falls. And you can't stop that. You can't. And so people are afraid of it, but I think that, you know, a country of major governments are not going to release killer robots that break the Geneva Conventions, because then those governments will be held accountable for those actions. So I would love to see robots programmed with, you know, human rights and military law. I think that, like all other jobs, they would do it better than we would, and hopefully with much less or no loss of life. So I don't see those kind of technologies as a bad thing.
Okay, well, we'll see what that world looks like. In the meantime, have I noticed you being involved with or organizing pop-up events and announcing them? And if so, what kind of events are you involved in? What do people do these days?
I spent the better part of a year, almost 2 years, in a lab, really reinventing my 20-year career as a commercial developer into a humanitarian artificial intelligence developer, started to get noticed by the scientific community and by organizations like the transhumanist community and futurists, and a lot of people became interested in some of the ground I was breaking in artificial general intelligence that is accessible to, you know, the average person. So I get invited to do a lot of conferences and panels. One of them that happens monthly is called the Futurist Sessions. And you can find that event on Facebook. It's a monthly event where they change the panels depending on topic, and they talk about a lot of the things that we're talking about here in detail. So they do a whole seminar on income inequality, a whole seminar on artificial intelligence.
So what are the kind of people, and where do they meet? And
The future sessions right now is held at Soho House down in the West Village. What is that area called? The Meatpacking District, at a big fancy hotel. But it's generally the people who attend are the people on the panels are people like Gray Scott, the founder of Serious Wonder, who's a brilliant futurist in his own right, and does a lot of television appearances. Keith Comito of Lifespan.io. They do crowdfunding for longevity research to improve improve and extend the quality of life, especially for, you know, the older generation right now. It's basically, let's keep our parents and grandparents alive and healthier and happier so that they can benefit from some of the technologies that are being developed. And let's lose as few people as we can until we can get to a place where, you know, we lose virtually none. So those events are great. I try to participate in the community as much as I can. The Futurist Sessions being the kind of only official one, but a lot of them pop up all over the world. Meetups happen. People are really involved. There are a lot of people who are either involved in the technology or kind of see where things are going and want to participate in that discussion of how do we get there? What do we, how do we mitigate the bad effects and amplify the good effects? One of the ways is to make artificial intelligence available to everyone, because if the military only has one and they're sending a drone to get you and you have your own artificial intelligence that says, hey, there's a drone up there, let's get out of here. It kind of equalizes the playing field.
So how you describe this pop-up event, and at the same time we're all very aware of the commitments of major corporations like Google and Facebook, and like Facebook's recent disaster with their missile on their satellite that was going to bring free internet to a lot of people sort of dissolved on the launch pad. But how do you compare what people like yourself who are working at a small scale can bring us compared with large organizations like Google and Facebook can bring us?
I'm generally a fan of those companies, SpaceX and Facebook and Google and those companies that invest heavy resources into progress, technological progress and innovation. But there are weaknesses. There is a bureaucracy there. There is a design by committee that doesn't give them the freedom to make the gains that a small person with talent and vision can make. And if you look throughout history, you'll see that a lot of the major paradigm shifting inventions have been done by individual people. Turing, for example, influenced mathematics, artificial intelligence, computer science all by himself. Einstein did the same for physics. Stephen Hawking did the same for quantum mechanics. Even going back to Galileo and people who. So I think that it's underestimated the amount of impact that a single inventor can have in the world, and that's still true today.
I know. If you look at all the biggies of the past 40 years, Apple, Microsoft, AOL, Google, Facebook, in every case, small startups brought us a personal computer, not IBM.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get these things from IBM or AT&T or General Motors, or in every case, if the new technology comes from a small startup with a visionary leader, as opposed to a major corporation with unlimited resources, unlimited talent, and even governmental and regulatory advantages to controlling the field. I mean, if you look at it, modems were so illegal. I mean, not only that, somebody invented a little hard rubber, just a piece of plastic that would clip on the mouthpiece of a phone to give you more privacy in talking into the phone. He was sued and put out of business by the phone company. You know, God forbid putting a modem on a phone.
Corporations will often stifle innovation to protect their interests, and they're unlikely to build things that will disrupt their own industries.
Even if they could have owned the future, they don't have the imagination to do it.
Right.
So I just recently read what is it? It's the story of Xerox PARC. Something about lightning or something like that. And, you know, they invented the whole thing. They had the Xerox Star had a graphical user interface that could edit video. They invented the Ethernet network, the laser printer. They had the whole thing 10 years before the Apple Macintosh. And they not only did they kill it off, they had to bring in executives from the automobile industry to make sure they totally killed the thing off.
that can only last so long before the more efficient new upstart takes over. And we see that, you know, over and over again, renewable energy and the self-driving cars and things like that. You just reminded me with the old, the original hacker culture as we know it was invented before the computer was a common household item, and a lot of that hacking was done on telephones. And funny, a very famous hacker who eventually became known by the moniker Captain Crunch, because he discovered that the free whistle being given out in a box of Captain Crunch cereal generated the right tone that would allow you to make free phone calls.
And at the same time, the device to make the rest of the tones was called a blue box.
Right.
And who was selling blue boxes?
There were all kinds of boxes, actually.
Steve
gray,
Jobs.
Black. Yeah.
Steve Jobs was, yeah, you know, selling blue boxes before he started Apple.
Yeah. And so those guys kind of, you know, they started the tradition of taking apart existing technology and using it in new ways. And I try to continue that in the good sense of the term hacker and not the bad sense of the term hacker. So Google and Facebook and Watson and all these companies are great, and they're putting out major products. And one of the things that I do with my artificial intelligence platform is use those APIs to make the artificial intelligence smarter and better. So I actually use, like, Luna will ask Watson if there's a question that she thinks he'll answer. I use those APIs inside of the objective part of the brain, and so we're leveraging their technologies as I've been invited to Google a couple times, you know, and they ask, like, how do you pull this off? It's the same question you're asking with a big company versus a person. And I say, well, you know, you did most of the work for me.
Yeah. So listen, my guest today has been Louis Serrano. This is Visionaries. I'm John LaBelle. Tune in every Monday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Next week, we'll be talking about Joseph Campbell with the director of the Joseph Campbell Foundation. Thank you once again. And tell all your friends they can catch this today's show on the archives on prn.fm.